It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2018, the number of fatal drug overdoses in western Pennsylvania fell by about 43%. Still, in the Pittsburgh area, hundreds and hundreds of residents died from overdoses. But the number of deaths, the cost of treatment, the cost of imprisonment, they don't tell the stories of the victims and their loved ones left behind. Longtime Pittsburgh area journalist Scott Brown has captured many of those stories in his book, Hope and Heartbreak. Welcome to The Confluence, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Scott, you wrote that you were late waking up to the opioid epidemic. Was there a particular individual case that you heard about, or was it just the sheer mounting numbers that woke you up?
I think what woke me up is when I was working for Judge Scott Mears in Westmoreland County. He is in family court, and we kept noticing a lot of grandparents or relatives, aunts, siblings that were coming in and requesting emergency custody of a child because there was drug abuse, addiction in a home, and it wasn't safe for them. And as those kept adding up, I guess I started noticing more what was going on around me just simply by reading the newspaper, watching the news, and hearing about overdose deaths and just hearing about this, you know, the opioid epidemic. And it really piqued my interest. And unfortunately, I had a personal experience. A really good friend of mine, her son passed away from an overdose, and I was with her when she got the call. And it was heartbreaking. It was shattering. And that was really basically the tipping point that made me want to write this book. And as the title suggests, to go beyond the numbers, to tell the stories. I mean, we hear the statistics, we see the numbers, but we need to know what's behind the numbers so, we can empathize with people that are dealing with this. And I think that goes a long way, too, towards breaking the stigma.
You discovered a range of emotions in those left behind. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the hardest interviews I did, and my hands were literally shaking when I left the restaurant. I met a woman in Greensburg, and she lost both her sons within 7 hours. And her older son, he had dealt with addiction, and she and her family thought they had gotten past that. He had been clean for almost 10 years, had been doing great. And then unfortunately, he was in a car accident, broke some ribs, and was given medication that sent him on a spiral, unbeknownst to her, until her younger son woke her up one night and said, you know, hey, someone's, his name's Josh,
right,
is overdosed. And so by the time she got to him, paramedics got there, it was too late. And the younger brother, and they were best friends, was so distraught. The last thing he said to her was, because she was trying to see, are you okay? And he said, the last thing he said to her was, Mom, I love you, but get the F away from me. So she said, okay, he needs some space. And then a couple hours later, she came downstairs and he had died from an overdose. And to this day, and she'll never know if it was suicide or if he had tried the same drug as his brother for whatever reason,
because to ease his pain.
Yes, and he had never had a drug issue. And I mean, here's this poor woman, and we're talking, and I ask her, you know, there's holidays, there's birthdays. One of the sons, his favorite holiday was St. Patrick's Day. So she has all of these gauntlets that she has to go through every day. And what's heartbreaking too is she works with people dealing with dementia, and she said that, you know, a lot of times they forget, and they'll ask her, how are your kids? And it's just, yeah, that one was really tough. And again, I my hands were shaking when I left, and I said, hey, can I give you a hug? It's just stories like that are just they just leave such an imprint on you.
You spoke with parents of victims,
yeah,
with law enforcement, with care providers, coroners, those in recovery. Yet you spent the most time with Carmen Capozzi, whose son Sage died of an overdose. Why? Because he's both a grieving father and an activist. He's getting involved, has gotten involved.
That's exactly the reason. And Carmen is such a compelling figure because when Sage died, he could have said, not my problem anymore, and he didn't. He decided to stand up and fight back, rage against the machine, if you will, and that's really what he's been doing for the last 7 years. And he is such an important voice, and he does such important work. And it's funny, I spent a lot of time with him. I went with him to Harrisburg and back a couple of times. And while we were driving, he would get phone calls from people looking to get into treatment or looking to get their son or daughter into treatment. And those are his days. And in fact, part of the book is, and this is something Carmen really has to guard against, is self-care. Because sometimes he's so passionate about this that he comes very, very close to burning himself out. Mm-hmm. And that's something I know he has to deal with, is self-care.
Sage, I believe, made a video about addiction, and his father really didn't want him to make it, but now it turns around, Carmen uses that video?
He does. He does. And when Sage was making that video, his girlfriend was shooting it, and Carmen was walking by the bedroom, said, "What are you doing?" Sage told him what they were doing, and Carmen's response was, "Absolutely not. We're not going to broadcast our problems." And after Sage died, he realized that he and others, they stayed quiet for far too long. And that's one of the things that motivates him, is we need people to speak out. We need people to share their stories, their struggles. Because if not, if we keep this in the shadows, that is where this disease, where this epidemic thrives.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Scott Brown, author of Hope and Heartbreak Beyond the Numbers of the Opioid Epidemic. Scott, many surviving family members spoke with you for the book. I mean, it's one thing to do that, but did you find that many want to go out in public and speak, such as Carmen, maybe Michelle Schwartzmeier, who you spoke with? And Michelle and her daughter actually worked on an obit together?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly that. But what happened was Casey, Michelle's daughter, had been struggling with addiction, in and out of treatment. And she read an obituary one day in which it said the cause of death was addiction or overdose. And for whatever reason, that resonated with her. It made her feel less alone that day. And she and her mom had some long talks during those struggles. And during one of those, she said, "Mom, if something happens to me, I want you to write an honest obituary." And so when Michelle did that, she was honoring Casey's wishes. And she never dreamed what happened would happen, in that obituary went viral. I think she posted on Facebook, and it just took off around Pittsburgh, around the world. And really is one of Casey's legacies, and Michelle keeps that going too by telling their story. She's simply awesome, and she goes around, she'll talk anywhere for how long people need it. And I know she went to Clearfield School District, and when she went there it was 2 days, and she was talking to kids during the day, morning, and then adults at night. And the superintendent there told me that they had to force her to pay for the hotel. She wouldn't accept any money, not even for the hotel, and they finally insisted on it. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of passion she has, and she just wants to help, and she honors Casey every time she talks to groups and she talks to people in recovery, and she feels a real kinship with them.
In many cases, I think you discover there seemed to be a desperation to help their adult kids, their teenage kids, their adult kids in any way possible. Becky, a person you talked with, actually feared her daughter was on a binge, so she offered a reward on Facebook basically to help turn her daughter into police because of outstanding warrants.
Right, and she wanted to get her off the streets.
And into jail where she'd be safe?
Yes. I know it sounds crazy, but yes. And because she had lost contact with her daughter and feared that she was on some sort of drug run. And yes, she wanted to get her in jail because that and that's what some of these parents face. And you know, that wasn't even the craziest story. That day when I met with Becky and two others, another woman at the table One time she took her son to buy heroin and watched him shoot up.
And that's because he didn't want to get sick before he went into treatment?
Absolutely. And she, I mean, it shattered her heart. And basically, it was the better of two awful choices, because she feared that if he started getting dope sick, he would take off and wouldn't go into treatment. And that's one thing, too, that illustrates when someone's ready to go to treatment, we can't tell them, okay, we'll have a bed for you in a couple of days. They have to go right away, because something like that, you might have something like that where someone starts getting sick or they change their mind and you lose that opportunity. And if we're going to treat this as a disease, let's get people into treatment right away. If you're having a heart attack and you go to the hospital, they don't tell you, hey, come back in a couple of days when we have a bed.
We have about 90 seconds left. You spoke with people who are in treatment, who are clean, getting clean. Sometimes it's a very dramatic incident that led to sobriety, including Greg Powell. He was hit by a train.
He was. And I was just with Greg, and he recently celebrated 3.5 years of recovery. And he's still dealing with a lot of fallout from that accident. But, yeah, here's a guy that he figured he would die a heroin addict. And then he got hit by a train, and crazy. And maybe that's a fitting way, because there's so much crazy stuff about this epidemic. Getting hit by a train saved his life.
Possibly. All these shocking stories that I read in your book, possibly the most shocking comment came from Tim Phillips. He's the executive director of the Westmoreland County Drug Overdose Task Force. He is getting requests to talk to whom?
Kids in Head Start.
Head Start. Is that where we have to start now, that young?
Unfortunately, yes. And basically that's because they're growing up where they're seeing drug use in the home. And it's the thing is, with him and Head Start, they don't want kids to think that's normal. And it's uncomfortable, yes, but unfortunately in this day and age, it probably is necessary.
Pittsburgh journalist Scott Brown is the author of Hope and Heartbreak, Beyond the Numbers of the Opioid Epidemic. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Hundreds of Pittsburgh police officers turned out to honor one of their own this weekend in a ceremony to mark the end of watch. While the growth in fracking has brought new economic development in some communities, it's also bringing new health concerns for people who live near gas infrastructure. And with affordable housing on the decline and gentrification on the rise in Pittsburgh, a local organization is teaching residents about their rights and looking for solutions in Lawrenceville. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pennsylvanians prepare for their first statewide rehearsal against possible air raids in 1942. The Indiana Gazette reports that instructions were sent to county chairpeople with the times and durations of blackouts. The 30-minute tests were to simulate what it would be like if enemy planes and parachutists landed in western Pennsylvania. Pedestrians were encouraged to stay inside with their lights out, and industrial plants were asked to blacken their windows and appear as invisible as possible. The State Defense Council also announced that weekly 22nd tests would take place each Saturday until further notice. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Jamie Upshaw of Hazelwood says it was difficult to get a proper autism diagnosis for her youngest son. She says it was even harder to find the proper resources that her family needed when that diagnosis was ultimately made. Upshaw has since started her own support group called Autism Urban Connections. She spoke with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort.
There was nothing out there that was geared toward our African-American community. So I kind of just jumped in head first and started Autism Urban Connections. And we've been going strong for 4 years now. We've actually incorporated as a nonprofit in September of 2018. So we're looking to continue to move forward.
What do you do specifically?
We offer online supports. We offer workshops. We do 2 annual events. We do a lot of outreach in the communities. We partner with a lot of organizations. We do the monthly meeting groups where we actually do that 3 times a month.
What do other parents like yourself say you need? What kinds of supports?
In most cases, I've found we all kind of need that shoulder to cry on. May it be we're happy that somebody listened to us and we finally got the right diagnosis, or it may be that we're going through the grieving process because we had these hopes and dreams for a child that their future was kind of altered. And then I also found a lot of families need resources, wraparound services, service coordination. We can guide you in the right directions to get you any services that you need, maybe medical assistance, social security, early intervention. We're here to provide the resource and the assistance to help you get what you need.
What more would you like to do for your parents who have autistic children?
I hone in on self-care from my parents and caregivers. That's one of my biggest things in AUC. Self-care is imperative for our parents and caregivers, because if we're not taking care of ourselves from the top, we can't work our way on down to the bottom. We have to make sure that we are caring for ourselves. And that means putting our best foot forward, whatever that may be for you for today. Everybody measures up differently. Don't compare yourself to what another parent is doing. Your measure of success is something different than somebody else's. And wherever you're at, we're willing to meet you. We're willing to help you. We want you to be your best self, to be that best parent for your child.
Why do you have this passion for helping other parents? You could have taken the information that you sought to help you and your family and your son. What is it about you that you want to share that with others?
I remember a good friend of mine said to me, "What good is knowledge if it's not shared?" I want to share everything I know. If I can teach somebody to be a better them, to not have to fight so hard in a system that is really hard fighting, if I can help them navigate that in a little smoother capacity, I'm here. I want them to be able to get what they need.
Jamie Upshaw, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Police Officer Calvin Hall will be laid to rest this week. Officer Hall was off duty early Sunday morning, July 14th. When he was shot in the back 3 times at a block party outside of a friend's house in Homewood. Hall died of those wounds Wednesday. He was 36 years old. The Tribune Review's Megan Guza has reported on the memorials thus far. Megan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, tell us what you've learned about Officer Calvin Hall and how he's being remembered.
By all accounts, he was just someone who cared greatly. His family has said that, friends, fellow officers. He was specifically put into the substation that the police have in the Northview Heights housing complex because of his great relationships that he was able to form with the community.
So he was able to strengthen bonds or even start bonds between police officers and residents of the neighborhood.
Exactly.
Funeral proceedings for a police officer, they can take several days. You attended a final roll call ceremony on Saturday. Let's hear a bit of those proceedings now. This is a dispatcher followed by Police Chief Scott Schubert, also on the radio.
Base Unit 3181, Officer Calvin Hall, Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, badge number 4673.
Unit 3181, Officer Calvin Hall, Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, badge number 4673, is out of service.
Texas, Unit 31H1, Officer Calvin Hall. 6-4-0, please. Status number 4673 is out of service. End of watch, July 17, 2019. Lest we forget, this concludes the final roll call. Resume normal transmission.
Megan, you heard some of the reactions, some of the sadness of officers. You were there. Would you describe that moment for us for the final roll call?
It's just one of the most solemn things you'll ever experience. You know, there are hundreds of officers there standing at attention outside of the Zone 1 station, family, friends of Officer Hall, and just some people from the neighborhood as well, because it's a residential area there. And I never thought the North Side could fall silent like that, but it absolutely was for upward of 10 minutes.
And you mentioned many, many people, and not just brother and sister officers.
No, like I said, his friends and family were there. He had a fiance, and again, just community members, some from Northview Heights who knew him, and others who just came out of their homes on the North Side to watch these, you know, final moments of his life as a police officer.
What's the significance? This is a very formal and solemn procedure, as you said. What's the significance of the final roll call?
It's honoring his time as a police officer, and it's kind of a we'll take it from here type moment. You know, the dispatcher is essentially trying to make contact with Officer Hall, and the silence that follows after she reaches out is just deafening. And then, as you can hear in the recording, after Chief Schubert finished saying that Officer Hall was out of service, it's just a short phrase, but it's so powerful when you have that context. And you can hear in the recording, you know, reactions from family, officers, loved ones.
A viewing is today from noon to 8 p.m. at Soldiers and Sailors in Oakland, and tomorrow the funeral. Both are public. How can people pay their respects? What do you expect to see and hear about this officer who was actually in this force for really just a few years, although he was on other police forces?
I expect you'll see just a constant line in and out today at Soldiers and Sailors. And I can't even fathom how many will come to the funeral tomorrow. The family has graciously, again, opened all of this up. And the sense I'm getting from those within the department is they're kind of like, well, we knew that we loved him, but all these other people loved him too. Mm-hmm. Yes, let them in, invite them.
And standard procedure, do we expect officers from around the state and maybe other states to attend the funeral as a standard procedure for when an officer dies?
Oh, without a doubt. There were officers from across the county and some state police at the final roll call on Saturday night. So I imagine it will be even farther on Tuesday.
Any update about the person or persons who may have shot Officer Hall?
Police have not released any updates. As with most investigations, they're being pretty tight-lipped. The last we heard was, you know, last week when there was a person of interest they were speaking to.
Megan Guza is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Megan, thanks so much for coming in.
Of course. Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. While the growth in fracking has brought new economic development in some communities, it's also bringing new health concerns for people who live near gas infrastructure. In this final installment of the series, Who's Listening?, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that some Ohio residents are starting their own effort to track the health impacts of fracking.
A dozen people are scurrying around a church basement in Youngstown, Ohio. They're arranging tables and chairs, setting up paperwork, and hanging up signs that read Ohio Health Registry.
Well, the Ohio Health Registry is really an attempt to collect the contacts of people who live close enough to any aspect of shale development that they might be affected.
This is Dr. Deborah Cowden, who started this effort. She's a family physician near Dayton and drove 3.5 hours east this morning to organize the registration. Cowden's group created a series of forms that take about 15 minutes to fill out.
This is the medical questionnaire, and I'm going to read some instructions first.
They ask people about their proximity to gas development and about current health symptoms, everything from levels of fatigue, nausea, and asthma, to cancer, mental health, as well as family health history. 60-year-old Martin Sinjenik, a truck driver, filled out the registration forms. He's heard about a new frack waste injection well being permitted near his home.
I live less than a mile from what they're building there, and I'm worried about it.
Sinjenik doesn't think the state is ensuring his drinking water well will be protected from contamination, but he doesn't know how the health registry will help.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It might not do anything. I don't know.
More and more studies have been making connections between living near gas development and the risk of some health problems like headaches and anxiety, low birth weight babies, and even cancer. Cowden wants the health registry to provide data that will help further this kind of research as fracking continues to grow in the state.
If we're going to do this, why are we not attempting to keep track so that we might be able to help people if they have a problem?
Ohio regulators say they do respond to health concerns. Rebecca Fugit is Assistant Chief of the Bureau of Environmental Health and Radiation Protection at the Ohio Department of Health. Fugit says they just don't get many complaints from citizens about the fracking industry.
No, we only get maybe just, it's less than 5 a year. I mean, to be honest, it really is. We don't get very many.
The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which regulates the oil and gas industry, also gets few health complaints from people living near these operations. The Allegheny Front analyzed thousands of complaints by citizens to ODNR between 2009 and 2018 and found just 10 reporting headaches, rashes, and breathing problems. But ODNR did get more than 400 complaints about odors. Certain odors can indicate pollutants in the air. Fugit says the health department does respond to citizens who think pollution from oil and gas development or anything else is harming their health.
And we work with them on a case-by-case basis to investigate their complaint, to collect environmental data as needed to, you know, respond to their concerns and determine if they have been exposed to any contaminants.
Fugit says Ohio tracks various health statistics, just not specifically in relation to fracking activity. And Pennsylvania and Colorado do have registries for people living near the oil and gas industry to report their health concerns. But some health advocates say they're not doing enough.
I'll tell it like it is. I think it's shameful.
That's Raina Ripple. She runs the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. She wants the government to proactively collect community-wide health data on people in shale gas communities so it can better regulate the industry and protect public health. Her organization started a national health registry for fracking in 2017. An analysis of the first 100 to register found that people living within a quarter mile of gas development were more likely to report coughs, headaches, and anxiety compared with those a mile or more away. But she says this kind of data should be collected in a more systematic way.
I mean, we have to do our best, I'd say, to really fill in the gap. I think that this is really us, these small groups, these groups that don't have a lot of resources, doing the work that we know needs to be done, and hopefully the states and or the federal agencies will ultimately pick up the ball that they've dropped.
Marcellus Drilling News, an industry publication, criticized Ripple's project, writing that it encourages people to blame every headache and cough on gas development.
The medical questionnaire begins by asking about your past health.
Meanwhile, the Ohio group so far has 65 people on its registry, and with more registrations like this one in Youngstown, is hoping to reach 200 by the end of the year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story is the final installment of the Allegheny Front's series, Who's Listening?, about fracking in Ohio. It's supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the Sear Sweatland Family Foundation. The entire series can be found at alleghenyfront.org/who's listening. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Affordable housing and gentrification, two issues the city of Pittsburgh as a whole and its individual neighborhoods have been confronting for years. The nonprofit Lawrenceville United is hosting its annual Housing for All event Saturday, July 27th. The executive director of Lawrenceville United is David Bringen. David, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
City officials, including the mayor, acknowledge that Pittsburgh needs thousands more affordable housing units across the city. If you would, give us an overall assessment of the housing issue in Lawrenceville.
Well, we have seen housing prices skyrocket in the last few years. At the same time, we're seeing one of the largest housing booms in the neighborhood in decades. Alongside that, we're also seeing big levels of displacement. So we've seen a third of our Black population lost in just 3 years. Over half of our Section 8 vouchers were lost between 2011 and 2016. And we also know that this is affecting some longtime homeowners as well, who are getting exposed to some additional pressures by the private market.
So has this been going on for years, or has the housing situation changed much in the 5 years since you started holding these events?
It's been, the change in Lawrenceville has been really quick and really dramatic. Between 2010 and 2017, our median home sale price more than doubled. We went from, just 10 years ago, it was pretty rare to see sales over $100,000. You know, our median home sale price in 2017 was $240,000. Mm-hmm. So the change has been extremely quick, which makes it a challenge to keep up with.
What's the purpose of this year's Housing for All event?
Well, this is really an education opportunity and sort of a resource fair for folks in the neighborhood to get access to a whole variety of resources and sessions really focused on the most pressing housing needs in the neighborhood. So we have sessions devoted for homeowners, and specifically a lot of that content focuses on our older adult folks who are on fixed incomes or low-income homeowners who have a unique set of challenges. So, you know, how to deal with property violations, how to get access to home repairs, what to do if your home, you know, has major deficits, and what are your legal protections if with construction next door, things like tangled title assistance and estate planning. And then on the renter side, we're going to have Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts there who will be talking about the procedures and laws that apply to landlord-tenant cases and what housing court really looks like. Evictions, are a problem in the neighborhood, and we want to make sure that people are educated about their rights and what that process looks like so they can be proactive.
Right. Has eviction been a growing problem in Lawrenceville?
It has. And when we look at some of the data, what's really unfortunate is that we're seeing it. It's in particular being used against single parent households with school age children. So when we think about who's being affected by displacement in the neighborhood, it's really affecting our kids, which is tragic. And we want to make sure that we're preserving a neighborhood that can keep those families.
The Navigating Housing Court sessions are hosted by Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, who appeared on the Confluence recently. You've held similar programs over the years. Have the needs of residents changed much? Are you updating that educational programming?
Yes. Each year it does change a little bit. I mean, one of the things that I think we've become a little bit more attuned to in the last couple of years is those longtime homeowners and those low-income seniors who own their homes that I was talking about a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. They're being exposed to a lot of pressure from investors and flippers. We now have evidence that of flippers actually targeting some of these folks with violations on their home, with, you know, like a citing, getting a 311 report for a minor property violation, waiting till they get that violation, and then following up with a lowball cash offer on their house. So really taking advantage of some of our older adults who may not know how much their home is worth these days, and can be really intimidated by a notice of violation from the city.
Do you work with similar organizations in other neighborhoods that might be experiencing the same challenges when it comes to a greater need for affordable housing or the fears of gentrification?
Absolutely. We've in the last couple of years, we've recalibrated a lot of our efforts to focus more on advocacy. And as part of that, we've joined in coalition with other organizations across the city. Pittsburgh United has been a really crucial partner for us. They host a housing justice table, which brings together a number of community organizations and advocacy organizations that are dealing with some of the same issues that we are. So not only are we sharing resources about, you know, how to actually provide resources to our tenants and our residents for home repairs and for rental assistance and all of those things, but also creating a coalition that can drive policy.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is David Bringen, Executive Director of Lawrenceville United, which this Saturday will host its annual Housing for All event. David, Pittsburgh City Council Wednesday is expected to approve a new affordable housing measure, a pilot project for Lawrenceville. Briefly, what would this plan entail?
So it's called inclusionary zoning. It's used all across the country in about 900 different municipalities. It's been around for a while, and it's a proven program for making sure that as new development occurs, that you're creating housing opportunities for everyone. So essentially what this legislation would do is that for residential projects above 20 units in Lawrenceville, they would be required to provide 10% of those units for families earning 50% area median income or less in the case of rentals, and at 80% area median income or less in the case of for sale units.
You testified last week at a public hearing regarding this legislation. You said it was urgently needed. Why so?
Just some of the statistics that I cited earlier. I mean, all of us who live in Lawrenceville, we can rattle off, you know, a dozen folks who used to be our neighbors who've been priced out of the neighborhood. So we're seeing this huge housing boom. We're seeing, we've seen a 15% increase in our housing units in the last 5 years. And at the same time, we're seeing, you know, many of our dear neighbors get priced out of all of the new opportunities that reinvestment in Lawrenceville, a safer neighborhood, you know, better public schools, better public transportation, all those things are bringing. So it's essential that we take advantage of this moment to make sure that we're creating housing opportunities for everybody and not just some folks.
The city has been trying a variety of measures to deal with affordable housing shortage and gentrification, such as community land trusts, affordable housing trust fund. Are these helping? What more could the city be doing for Lawrenceville and maybe the city at large?
Yeah, I think, there's still a lot to be done. And, one thing that we've reminded folks is that inclusionary zoning is not alone going to solve all of our housing woes. We do need a variety of measures to tackle this problem. On a state and federal level, we just need more resources for community development corporations to build affordable housing, but we also need additional policies. Going back to homeowners, one of the things that we heard really loudly during some of our community engagement around inclusionary zoning is for those low-income seniors who own their homes, they're really concerned about the next property tax reassessment. There's been legislation introduced at the state level that would authorize the city to pass long-time owner-occupant protections, which would protect long-time homeowners from getting priced out of their homes for taxes just because their neighborhood gentrified around them.
And last Tuesday, I believe it was, the U.S. Department of Interior added Lawrenceville to the National Register of Historic Places. What does that mean to your organization, the residents of Lawrenceville, and does it have any impact on the issue we're talking about?
So it's a nice feather in our cap. I mean, Lawrenceville is a historic neighborhood, so it is a nice recognition of that. I should say it only creates incentives. It provides no restrictions for private property owners on what they can do with their property, but it does open up some resources in the way of historic tax credits, which can actually go alongside the goals of affordability. And we've seen that actually in some recent projects.
David Bringen is Executive Director of Lawrenceville United, which this Saturday will host its annual Housing for All event. We'll have a link to more information about the event on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. David, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, vacant lots can be both an eyesore and a drain on a community, but a local nonprofit is working with neighborhoods and property owners to clean up and redevelop those sites. And Christmas might be 156 days away, but a regional group of holiday performers feel the Yuletide spirit all year round. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.